What does it really mean when Yeshua, or Jesus, says, "Follow me"? In Luke 9 and the closing chapters of Leviticus, we discover that biblical faith is not intellectual curiosity or a social media follow, but a costly, urgent, all-in commitment. Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, on the internet at hallel.info. This study traces the biblical pattern of hear, commit, do. We unpack Yeshua's hard words about delayed obedience and explore vows, tithes, and jubilee. They're heaven's training ground for a people who keep their word because they carry the name of the King before the world.
Luke chapter 9, we saw that Yeshua is saying several times, multiple times, "Follow me." But the responses he was getting was varying forms of, yeah, does it have to be right now? And that's one of the questions that each one of us should be asking when we get the call from heaven to move forward and to be following along the path that the Lord is leading on. Is, yeah, but I've got to do this, and yeah, but I've got to do that, and you know, I've got other commitments. Does it really have to be right now? But the party's coming. Yeah, I got all kinds of things we got planned for it. So does it have to be right now? So one of the things that when we see this, and the actual thing that we have to be looking at is, does this confession really obligate us to move forward? And yes, it does, because the Bible is repeatedly joining these three ideas here together. You hear it, you commit to it, and then you do it. Or as you see a common way that that's described throughout the Bible as walking. You see a common way that it's, or you say, might say a living metaphor is walking, and then the direction that you're going called a path, and the words of the Lord instructing us on what this path is in these ways. And what we saw here today is, you could say, looking at the end of a book, yes, the end of one of the books involved there, the book of Leviticus, but it was talking about some very special kinds of promises, two of which are called vows, and the other one is called the tithe. And these, as we'll see, are these commitments that we're making, one of which is a voluntary commitment, the vow, and the tithe is one that is prescribed. It's a certain number or a certain proportion of what comes automatically. So one of the things that we see is that, yeah, there is a hearing, there is a committing, and there is a doing. So when Yeshua is saying, "Follow me," and you hear from both him several times throughout the Gospels and also from his apostles, one of the things that you hear is a warning that, yeah, you hear it, but if you don't do anything, then what good is any commitment that you make from it? If you say, "Yeah, I'm going to do it," or "Yeah, I'm going to do it," and you don't follow through, what good is it? It used to be that old saying that guys would have is that, you know, man's word is his bond. If you say, "Yes, I'm going to commit to doing something," you follow through with it. They call it like a handshake agreement. Used to be in this area here in agricultural country, the handshake agreements were how most of the business here in wine country got done. A lot of grape purchase contracts going back decades used to be done on handshake agreements. Is that you would say, "Okay, yeah, how much are you going to sell? Okay, how much are you going to buy it for? All right, and what are some of the parameters? Okay, that's great." You shake on it, and you go off, and you kind of make note down, "I've got to deliver so much at this particular point in time," and that's the way it would be. But over time, what ended up happening? You had to start writing things down in more detail, and then more detail. And then the lawyers got involved. And then the contracts got longer and longer and longer and longer. And then the contracts would end up in court because people would fight on both sides. Did you really say that? What about this? Is there some way that I can get out of that? Or there's a lot of that going on right now with the grape contracts, because right now the wine industry is in a bad situation. And there are a number of wineries that are trying to get out of their grape contracts. And they're trying all kinds of things. And one of the key ways that they're getting out of grape contracts is saying, well, the quality isn't quite what it was supposed to be. And then coming up with various ways of describing that grape quality as to whether it was this or whether it was that. Well, the key that gets then to a lot of what we read here today is what you are saying and what you're hearing. You might hear, the winery hears, oh, you got grapes. All right. Well, in a good market, if you hear that a grape grower has got grapes, that's a great thing, because you want to go over and get those as soon as you possibly can. And people were bidding and overbidding for grape contracts because you just couldn't get it, especially the really great grapes around here. And if in this kind of a market where not a lot of wineries want the grapes, if you hear a winery wants grapes, then you have every grape grower and the grandmother are over there banging on the door to say, hey, take my grapes. And then, you know, as they say, this is a buyer's market where the wineries can pick any ones they want. And now they don't want even what they have, so they're trying to get rid of it. And it all gets back to, you hear a deal, you then decide, what do you want to do? You say, or you put some sort of commitment forward, you make a commitment, and then what? You do it, or as they use the professional term of executing the contract. Well, one of the things as we see and going on here in that passage we looked at in Luke 9, verses 57 through 62, we saw that there was these three responses to follow me. These are this parable of the would-be disciples. You got one first volunteers, hey, I will follow you wherever you go, there in Luke 9:57. So then Yeshua follows that up and is warning him, hey, the Son of Man, it may be that you don't understand what you're getting yourself into with this situation, that the accommodations may not be by top class. You know, this might be the quadruple diamond rated accommodations that you may be expecting for the King of Israel, you know, the Messiah. Well, yeah, it may not be what you're thinking. So to another one, Yeshua commands, follow me. But then the man says he's got to go and bury his father. And the third one says, well, yeah, but first he wants to say goodbye. Go home and say goodbye. So you see the punchline, and one of the things when you're always, like we always say, when you're looking at parables, always look for the punchline to the parable, because that can help you stay on track with what the parable is actually about and not get lost in the details. And people may come up with all kinds of explanations for the various details in a parable. Larilla has a comment or a question over there.
In the gospel, according to some pastor I heard, what he had said, and I have no idea whether it's true or not, was that the man who said, let me wait and bury my father, his father wasn't even sick yet. Was that true, or is
That's one of the things we'll take a look at, because there's a lot of possibilities out there that people have come up with over the years for what was actually going on here. And something very similar has been put forward with the parable of the prodigal son. That's what it's called. Yeah, the parable of the prodigal son has a similar sort of flavor that some people have seen in it. So that's a good question. So one of the things that Yeshua says is the punchline to this, no one after putting his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God. There's recorded in Luke 9:62, which should also kind of get your bells ringing in your head about something you remember hearing back in the Hebrew scriptures, talking about the not the 300 at the Thermopylae, but a different 300. Yes. Talking about there with Gideon, S. And one of the things that you see is the punchline to that one that he's given in selecting his troops for that is what? The ones who actually will just scoop up the water and keep going. Those are the ones you stay with. The ones that like get down and like drink and slurp and have a get their fill. No, let those people go. So you, because you're separating out those who are ready to jump at the cause of action. Yeah, you keep those guys with you. The other ones, just let them go back home. But one of the things you keep saying is this testing of, I will follow, this commitment that comes from each one of them. I will follow. And is that something that is actually inside of them that will come out? Does their, what is that old aphorism about, what is it, saying with your lips or signing a check, there's something about something your lips can't cash or something. It goes back to that idea of basically say what you mean and then live up to it. But one of the things that you see is what the context of this passage is that this is in the context of what, and you just talked about in chapter 9 of Luke about Yeshua himself headed up towards Yerushalayim and towards Jerusalem. As it says there in Luke 9:51, he was determined to go to Jerusalem, or as it says there in Greek, he set his face toward Jerusalem. We hear about the great blessing that we have with called the Aaronic blessing. And we just talk about lift up your countenance or lift up your face. That's biblical language for when you turn your face to something, it is actually turning your attention and your focus towards something. So thus with that blessing, that's the creator of heaven and earth is going to turn his face toward you. He's turning his attention and then also his presence toward you. And that then is a foreshadowing of what that actually means about he set his face toward Yerushalayim, is that it was going to then result in his death and then the resurrection. But that's what was coming. So in the midst of it, Yeshua was having this declaration, you know, Jesus making his declaration that he was going to be setting his sights on where his end goal was, and he was ready to go to death because of what his mission was. His mission was going to take him to the end. But yeah, he set forward and moved toward that goal. So thus, people who are saying, okay, yeah, I'm going to follow you, you see that later on, he had to chastise some of his own closest students, those disciples who were said, yeah, we'll follow you wherever you go. Yeah. Really? Are you ready to drink whatever cup I am going to drink? Being ready to take on everything that I am going to take on. So thus we see that follow me, this instruction that you're seeing from the master here in Luke 9 is more than just say, I agree with you, or I accept your teachings. You know, I think it's intellectually curious. I'm intellectually curious about your teaching. So follow me does not mean, you know, click the little follow button on your browser or your app to say, oh, I'm going to get notifications. And every time that, you know, the Yeshua app has some great revelation, it's going to bing, give me a little notification, and I'm going to get some wisdom from heaven coming from it. That's not what follow me means. I mean, it may mean that in modern parlance when you're talking about social media or some sort of internet content you're getting, but what is that today? Are you really, when you click the follow button on something today on some social media, are you saying, I'm going to take it fully to the end? Wherever that's going, I'm going to go. Now, we all have commitment issues, don't we? With really committing to a lot of anything. Yes, John has got a comment or a question back there.
I've got some quotes.
Yes.
I think one I've heard is, your actions speak so loudly, I can't hear a word you're saying. Another one
interesting.
You're all bark and no bite. And I think from Top Gun, it's son, your ego is writing checks your body can't cash.
Yeah, that's closer to what I was thinking about earlier. Yeah. So yes, it is one of those things that you should always be committed on what it is you're actually committing to. And I am just terrible at that myself. I'm always ready to say yes to things that I should say no to. And I have to learn that really the hard way of I need to say no to more things because you're more likely to get me to say yes to things and then end up regretting it. So thus, one of those things when we're talking here today and we get down into some of where this lesson is going, it's as much to me as it is to all of us as believers. Yes, indeed. So when Yeshua is saying, no, this is not just believe that my teachings are correct. Rather, he's saying, go. Like the actual motion of or following means, you're actually going behind somebody. So if they turn, you turn. It's like when you're following somebody to a place that you've never been before, you know, we can go and with our great confidence in our GPS and other navigation systems, then hope we'll find the destination and hope it's programmed incorrectly. But we may find that it is actually incorrect or that it has a lot more nuances than we can get from just a general direction from our GPS system. So yes, it is actually about accompanying along for the journey. Are we ready to be going to wherever this destination is going to go? And you can think if you take this metaphor further, if you are following someone, and I've done that in times before, and you're following somebody and you're going through an area that looks a bit sketchy, are you going to say, maybe I'm just going to go back? It's getting a little bit worrisome. In areas where not just sketchy as in security-wise, but also sketchy as in safety-wise. There have been some cases where I was following somebody through a blizzard, and you know, it's like getting to whiteout conditions. I can't even see the road anymore, and all I'm down to is following taillights. And am I still going to just keep going following the taillights in front of me? So I learned that also the hard way and going through a blizzard one time following taillights, and suddenly the roads start getting a bit rough. And then it was getting a little bit rougher and then it evened out again. But then I started seeing headlights. Well, what had happened was that the person in front of me went over through the median and got up on the other side of the highway. And so, yeah, okay. So we had to then get back over to the other side that way. But yeah, I couldn't see where I was going. So I assumed the person in front of me knew where that person was going, but nope, I just ended up on the other side of the highway. So yeah, so always be careful about who it is that you're following and taking to the end. Lorilla has got a comment or a question. Oh, Lorilla's father did that one time?
On a Sunday evening after evening church.
Yes.
Where he grew up. And fortunately, he ended up in the driveway of the deacon of the church. So it was a whole lot better. And yeah, but
yes,
it was pretty bad in Oroville. So
yeah. Yeah, indeed. So this, in the language that we have here in Luke chapter 9, is very similar to what we have talked about throughout the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, about walking with the Lord and walking with Adonai. So with the first disciple, I will follow you wherever I go. Yeah, that's commitment. That's commitment. And maybe you should say, maybe you should have been committed for making such a commitment, but he was saying, oh yeah, okay, I'm right there, I'm going to go forward. But when Yeshua retorts, is like, hey, the Son of Man is nowhere to lay his head. How is it that are we actually ready for the commitment that's required? Not everybody is called to be this or that or any particular role. But for whatever role we're called to, are we actually ready to go through the course of what's required in that process? So our calling may be to something that is saying, okay, we got to get completely out of our comfort zone. We may be called to be one who is sent to a troublesome area where we're having to live kind of rough for a while, to another country where we're living even rougher. That may be our calling. And if so, are we actually fully in and fully depending upon God for this journey on we're going the way we're going? Or are we depending on our own strength in the process? So challenge is that we have to match our enthusiasm for the task with our connection. And also, you know, what we are realistically getting ourselves into. Yeshua told another parable about you don't build a tower before counting the cost for it. I mean, we see in our own state, we've got large projects in our state that are unfinished in the middle of nowhere out in the Central Valley because they had great ideas for such things that we were going to have. I mean, wonderful ideas. But, you know, you have high-speed rail in other countries. But other countries also are not like California. And it costs a whole lot more to do what you see in other countries to do it here in California. So are you actually ready for the cost of it to actually bring it to completion? Because just like what Yeshua says in the parable, if you don't consider the cost and it's left undone, what does Yeshua say? That people will say, ah, they will mock you because, hey, you said a great thing, you set up a great edifice, and then it all came down. We see that in the greater body of Messiah here today with, you know, some large organizations that have been set up, and they didn't quite count the cost. You've had some leadership that have not counted the cost of all the things that they have to give up to be in the ministry and yet have reached into places they should not have reached and gone to places with people they should not have gone. And then what happens? The whole thing comes crashing down. And what do people on the outside when they look at this say? Yeah, the dumb Christians, you know, they are just building these great edifices that are coming to nothing. Now, in the process, if you have those who are committed and are working forward on that, you can have the same operations that will reach all kinds of people and do marvelous things. But again, you have to then assess what is the cost of doing so. What is the cost? And the second disciple, the second student that came along, he was saying, yeah, but first I'm going to go bury my father. So back to Lorilla's point earlier, so they have several points that have been put forward over the centuries as to what was going on as the backstory of this guy and what was the reason that was leading up to this. Some of which was saying, yeah, his father may have just died, so this was an immediate thing. Some were saying his father may still be alive, so the request meant remaining home indefinitely. So, yes, my father's going to die at some point in time, so I need to be home to be ready to handle it whenever it does happen. Some have said that it was maybe a secondary burial of his father's bones, like a year later, as was typical in the first century. They would have an initial burial, and they would just basically, the tombs were typically tend to be communal, and that you would set the body out, the body would decompose, you come back typically a year later, and for the yahrzeit, as it came to be called in Yiddish, for the anniversary of the death, and then collect the bones and then put them in the boxes. And we've found lots of those. They're called ossuary boxes there today. They've dug up a number of them, you know, including some ones that, you know, still the jury is out, but some may be actually connected to Yeshua's family based on some of the writing that's been found on the boxes over time. But that is one possibility that's been put forward. So, yes, Lindsay has got a comment or a question over here.
I was just thinking that let the dead bury the dead,
yes,
in reference to us being alive. We've been baptized in the Holy Spirit, so we're alive. And so the dead tending to the dead, if he goes back, then he's no longer walking towards life. Also, didn't they have rules about tending to dead people?
Yes. Yeah, indeed. So that was something that was, you see some provisions that in the Torah itself, we read about them a few chapters ago in Leviticus about who would be handling and what, since Leviticus is tailored mostly to the priesthood, those rules are relating mostly to the priests and their family, if there's a death in the family of the high priest or one of the priestly clan, such like that. But the traditions came down about, and still it is the practice today in Israel and a number of Jewish communities, that if you have a death that you're looking to, depending on the sect, looking for burial within 24 hours. So that is a lot of what you'll see then, the haste into making sure that that happens quickly. So yes, there is then, you could say, the urgency involved. Anne's got a comment or a question. Isaiah?
Where does Shiva come in? I mean, that's...
Oh yes, seven. About... the time with the body, or the time of sitting with the family. Yes, that's with that role of the time period is usually like you got the first day and then the 7 days. So depending on the sect as to when that day of burial, and then the is that part of the first day, or is it then tacked on to beyond that, will vary by the sect. Oh, his excuse, yes, I have got to go sit Shiva or to have that memorial time period. Yeah, I mean, those are the very potential things for that. But it's, the punchline is what is always important for centering ourselves on where this is actually going. Or basically, let the dead bury their own dead. So it's one of those things, yes, you can have all kinds of care for your family, but if you have a tradition that is getting in the place of your ministry, you have to be extremely careful if which one is actually taking precedence, one or the other. You know, for example, we take it back to what we saw in Leviticus, the high priest... That is his job when he's on duty and throughout his life. So, yeah, he was restricted in what he could actually do as far as mourning and caring for the dead. So that then had to be something that was taken care of for somebody else. So, yeah, And that's a great thing to bring up in that regard. All right. So yeah, we don't get an explanation other than the punchline in this regard is to basically say, don't let that be an excuse for it. It's one of those things, if you have a significant concern, you can work around that if possible. But if you are, yeah, but, then there could be some sort of a deeper problem coming in there and saying, well, I'd love to do that, but yeah, I've got other things that are taking precedence in there. Because it's amazing if you're highly motivated to do something, how much the obstacles will shed away. You know, for example, if someone is really fond of a sporting event or some musical act or something like that, it's amazing what kinds of inconvenience you'll endure. Yeah, I remember back in high school going to watch a concert in January, and it was 40 below zero, and waiting in line outside of the concert hall for, I think, I don't remember exactly how long it was, but it was way too long. And since you're going into a concert hall, you don't usually suit up like you're going into the Arctic for that, because yeah, you're going to be in a place where it's going to be hot and jumping up and down and all kinds of stuff. So thus everybody is underdressed in 20, 30 below, 40 below weather. But wow, there was a long line there in the midst of that. So people were more than willing to be inconvenienced, even to maybe the point of injury, for the sake of your commitment to this or that or the other. And it's kind of a funny thing. I wasn't too excited about going to concerts after that. I wonder if there was some sort of correlation between that and, yeah. Maybe so. But yeah, we don't get the answer. But we do get the answer that says, okay, yeah, let the dead bury their own dead. But in Luke 9, verse 60, it says, but as for you, go and proclaim everywhere the kingdom of God. So yeah, the kingdom is an urgent job to those who are called, who respond to it. Because why? We can say that, especially if you drop in and see the passages that we just saw in Leviticus 26 and 27, it's like, wow, this is just bizarre. Where is all this, these instructions coming from? Well, these are instructions that are coming for the people who are acting as heaven's life preserver for earth. So you think of this as like the detailed instructions that are going to be given to all of the flight attendants on your flight. About, okay, if this situation happens, you need to be ready to get these exits open. Check to see if there's fire outside. If there's fire outside, you don't open those doors. You have to open up some other doors, or you have to do something else. And you have to do this procedure and that procedure to get people out. Because why? It is an urgent situation. If you have a crash or some sort of landing, you need to get the passengers out quickly and also safely to avoid as much injury as you possibly can. And the instructions that you have here that are talked about are for really heaven's life preserver, heaven's, you could say, safety flight attendant crew for Earth. And that is what you see, what is called Israel in this regard, to be there to help people get out of a plane, so to speak, that has gone down, but yet the people may not realize they need to start heading for the exits. They may be kind of in a daze. And you see that happens, and when we've had evacuation practices here, sometimes we get what they is called normalcy bias, is that we don't quite kick in and realize, hey, the situation has gotten a lot more dire. We have to start paying attention that this is something we need to pick up the pace, pick up the energy, get ready, start heading for the exits, etc. So in the same way, in a very similar way, you have these instructions that are given for Israel to help people find the exit, so to speak, of earth. And even if they don't realize that they are headed down that path. And that's part of what we looked at in Jeremiah chapter 16, which we'll be getting to here shortly. So with the third disciple that we read about in Luke chapter 9, I will follow, but first, da 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 da. And you can add pretty much all kinds of various excuses in here. Notice that it says in this there in Luke 9:61, I will follow you, Lord, but first. So thus you have the acknowledgement of Lord, or as we say, Kurios, Master, I will follow you, but first I will do something else. So Lord is supposed to be acknowledging what? Someone has authority or supremacy above you, right? But then you're saying, but first, so something else then has authority or primacy over who you just called Lord. So that's what you see, is a very similar thing that Yeshua said back in Luke 6:46. He said, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? So, very similar statement. And you see back in the prophets, they said a very similar thing, where they were talking about, oh, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, thinking that the presence of the house of God in their midst was going to save them from the calamities that were going on all around them. Well, it's not like a lucky charm or a talisman that you slap up on the side of something and it's going to do something effectual. No, rather it is something that is happening within the hearts of all the people that is bringing the people to act. And if the inside of the people, the hearts of the people, are sick, there's darkness inside, then is a talisman going to help? No. Talisman is going to do absolutely nothing. And that then is what the creator of heaven and earth has to keep reminding heaven's life preserver to keep saying, hey, pay attention here. This is not like the nations around you where they would set up their temple. They've got their images or their statues and they say, oh, you are going to come protect us, rather than saying, no, the one who created everything, including the stone or the metal or whatever it was that you used to make your image or your statue, that one is where the help actually comes from. So getting the priorities is completely turned around. And that the imagery of talking about and no one puts their hand to the plow and then looks back is worthy of me is similar to something we see that points back into the time of two prophets, two really big major prophets of Eliyahu and Elisha, or Elijah and Elisha. And this part here is recorded in 1 Kings 19, verses 19 through 21. So he departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, while he was plowing with 12 pairs of oxen before him, and he with the 12th. And Eliyahu passed over to him and threw his mantle on him. He left the oxen and ran after Eliyahu and said, please let me kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow you. And he said to him, go back again, for what I have done For what have I done to you? So he returned from following him and took the pair of oxen and sacrificed them and boiled their flesh with the implements of the oxen and gave it to the people, and they ate. And then he arose and followed Eliyahu and ministered to him. So something very similar to what we had just seen with that parable there in the Gospels. So we have Eliyahu finds Elisha plowing, and then he calls him. And then Elisha asks for permission to say goodbye to his parents before following Eliyahu. So very similar. We've got the call to follow to what we've seen in Luke, a request to say goodbye to family. We got the plow. But you see that Yeshua's response to this disciple, this potential student, is even more demanding. No one, after putting his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God. But one of the things that you see that, yeah, okay, the prophet Eliyahu's call for his successor, this, you could say, prophet in training with Elisha, was a very important call. But you see that finally Elisha got the message and said, oh, okay, yeah, I'm making an excuse here. So what does he do? He says, okay, that this, I've got to basically, burn the bridge behind me, so to speak, with offering part of his team of oxen as an offering, and then saying talking about the yokes and the implements for his farming, to basically burn it all down behind him, to say, and there's that old imagery of about burning the ships when you make land somewhere, burning the ships. So why? You can't get in the ships and go back. You can't go back again. So thus you see a similar sort of imagery there with Elisha saying, okay, I have basically ended this chapter of my life, and now I'm moving forward with a new chapter of my life. So it gets back to our passage we see in Leviticus 26, and some of how it starts out there in verse 3. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments so as to carry them out. So we see there are some three key Hebrew words there of halach, which is translated walk, shamar, which is translated to keep or to guard, and asa, which is translated to do or to perform. It can also mean make as well. But you see in the sequence is very important about walking, then guarding, and then doing. So one of the things that you see throughout the Torah is that it is not just information. This is not just a reading society where you just get together and go, huh, oh, that's interesting. But rather, these are instructions for life. And when you look into the bigger world, since this is a commission from heaven to have a life preserver for the whole world, this is not just for your own little clique to have your own secret handshake, so to speak, to where you get in. No, this is training for being a part of the rescue program that heaven is doing for all of planet Earth. So, yes, Yeshua's follow me instructions in these three instances recorded in Luke 9 fit right along with this. About you have allegiance, so you move it forward into action. Lindsay's got a comment or a question over here.
Also, yes. I'm sorry. Also, I just wanted to add that when he states to follow me and go proclaim, one of the reasons we do that, which is something you brought up a little while back, is that faith comes through hearing. And so we proclaim it so the seeds can be planted.
Yes, indeed. And one of the things that when you talk about biblically hearing, the verb, see, Hebrew is a verb-based, for the most part, language. So one of the key things about hearing is the verb shema. And shema, as the way it's normally used throughout the Bible, is not just like, hearing, kind of like, you know, you got like the radio playing in the background and you're doing something else. This is like hearing as if, okay, these are instructions. So pay attention, because what? You're going to be doing it. So it's kind of like back to the beating the metaphor of the flight attendants to a terrible degree. This is like what we always do when we get on a plane and they get on the announcements and they get up there with the flight life preservers and they're blowing in them. And, you know, they got the seatbelt little thing and showing you how to lift the handle up and this and that and the other. And most of us are do what? Blah, 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 just ignore it. However, if you were like thinking, okay, we're actually going to need this here on this particular flight. How much more attention would we all pay to that? Okay, how does that go up? Okay, which direction is it going? Okay, yeah, you actually blow, when you blow into it, do I have to keep blowing into it or is it going to like stop? Or do I have to put my thumb on it to keep the air inside my life preserver? In a sense there, yeah, the instructions become more urgent if we think, oh, we actually have to do something about this. Or yeah, if you've been at work and you get instructions from your boss, imagine if we treated our instructions from our bosses like we do the instructions there and the safety instructions on a flight. And it's like, yeah, boss, blah, 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 blah. Although I have worked with people who did treat the briefings from the boss sort of like that, and thus you have similar issues that have ensued because you're not paying attention to what the instructions are, that you actually have to put these into action. So one of the things that we see in these two chapters that close out the book of Leviticus in Leviticus 26 and 27 that these blessings and curses are really a test to see, is Israel, are the people of God actually going to listen? And if you listen, are you actually going to do it? Because a whole part of this is, if you listen, if you hear, then do what? Do it. If you hear, then start walking, start carrying out the task to move forward with it. Yeah, John has a comment or a question back there.
Just reminded me, it's also probably good to remember that the word belief implies in the Hebrew, I think understanding of the word belief implies doing as well.
Well, it depends on which one that you talk about belief. There's one that's boteach is the form of that, or batach. And batach is usually translated as belief. It means to trust or to put your dependence upon that. So yeah, it goes along with that.
Because I think people in English today will say they believe something, and it's right. Just like an ethereal idea.
And yeah, you do bring up a very interesting point, because that batach, they're the often translated belief in Hebrew. In the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures, that's usually translated, if not mistaken, with pistis, which is what you see often in the New Testament, the apostolic writings, as translated believe, even in passages like John 3:16, you know, whoever believes. But that is in the sense of not just, oh yeah, that's an interesting concept. Yeah, I agree with that concept. Actually, okay, you agree with it, but what are you going to do about it? That's more of what batach and pistis are about. Oh yeah, okay, you hear it. Now what? Yes, Lindsay, go ahead.
And just to continue the thought a little bit, is that in today's culture, we do not act on the word like they did in, you know, like I couldn't imagine some person coming up to me saying, follow me, and me dropping my fishing net and going. Like that concept seems so foreign to our culture, and people want to get baptized, but then they wait sometimes months to go out and get baptized because it's not on the church calendar. And there's a loss of urgency to go.
Yeah. So that's like, you know, when you see the example that you have in the book of Acts, where after, you know, the one of the, he's often called the evangelist there, Philip, and he's there with the Ethiopian delegate, and they're reading from Isaiah, and they get to Isaiah 53, and so the Ethiopian's trying to understand this, you know, and it's very interesting. What he asks about is exactly what you see a lot of naysayers of Isaiah 53 say about it today. Well, no, was he talking about himself or Israel or somebody else? Because that's something that he was starting to realize, it seems like he's talking about somebody else in this regard. And so thus you see Philip then starts expounding upon what that particular passage means and other passages throughout the Hebrew scriptures that are referring to the Messiah and who the Messiah would be. And so the end result is that you see what was the call of the Ethiopian delegate. He's like, well, that sounds great. Let me see. Maybe I'll get back to that in a year or two. No, he's like, hey, here's some water. It's time. It's mikveh time here. Let's go and get washed. And so like, yeah, okay. Now is the time. So yeah, that's a great point. Is that yeah, the washing of the word happened before the washing of the body, but that urgency of action of saying from that Ethiopian to say, yeah, I need to make this change now. And this change, I really have to start walking differently now, not wait for some other period of time. But yeah, it has to start happening now. Yeah, great, great observation on that one. So yeah, you have the promises that come here in Leviticus 26, and this is very similar, and we'll see, to the ending part of Deuteronomy has very similar, they call blessings and curses. This is, if people from other cultures there in the ancient Near East would have seen these particular documents, they would have recognized them, because this is a very sort of similar thing that you see in legal documents and government documents of the time period, where you have what's come to be called the suzerain vassal agreements, where you have the suzerain or the high king, the emperor, and then the vassal or the under king or lesser ruler, and you have this agreement between the two of them. And basically the agreements usually go with, these are all the good things that are going to come from this relationship, blessings, and then curses. If you don't do these things, this is all that's going to come down on your head as a result of this. So thus, what you're seeing here is an agreement of this relationship between heaven and earth it's being really wrapped up and finalized. In Leviticus, the whole book is tailored mostly to the priesthood, so you could possibly say that this was to all of the priesthood. So basically, the people who it is their task to be closest to really helping the people and their relationship with God, them specifically saying, okay, yeah, this, if you lead properly, if you help the people get closer to the creator of heaven and earth, these are all the wonderful things that are going to result of your activity in the culture and everything like that. But if you don't, all these things are going to go off the rails. And as we look throughout the rest of the Bible, that's exactly what happened. The priesthood went off. They lost their script. They completely forgot who their boss was. They started working for another boss and still claiming they had their previous boss. And what happened? A whole society went right downhill, because the priesthood, their job, among other things, was to teach the people, to inform the people, to keep them on track, to say, okay, this is who God is. If you have the people whose task is to do that, to then serve some other boss, I mean, how are you then going to keep any sort of cohesion in what your original task is? I mean, you just think about that right now. I mean, most companies, including the one I work for, we all have a an exclusivity clause in our contracts, our employment contracts. We're basically saying you can't go work for a competing company while you're working at this company, especially not while you're on the clock. And sadly, that we've had some incidents where that indeed has happened. But that's the case, is that if you're working for one boss, you just can't go off and work for some other boss, and then in the process. And then while you're working for the other boss, bring all of that and their business into the business that you're supposed to be working in. And then all of the people in your company, so to speak, and all of your customers are totally confused about what company is this? And thus you have exactly what we see in the Bible that happened throughout the history. As you go and you read the history books in the Bible down into the prophets, you have basically had the priesthood were working for a different boss while they were on the clock for the original boss, the creator of heaven and earth. And thus the rest of the people, the rest of the priesthood were confused, since the top priests were confused and the people were confused. They had no clue. And they just started to then say, okay, well, I guess we've got the name on the door is the same as it was before, the house of the Lord, but it's actually the house of somebody else now. And we haven't just changed the name on it yet. So, you know, if we think all this stuff is just talking about people long, long, long ago, no, it still happened. It's still with us today. It is still same as it ever was, indeed. So a recurring issue is, yeah, you're not listening. Or you could say you are, there are vibrations that are bouncing off your tympanic membrane. And maybe there are signals that are jutting in from your auditory nerves into your brain, but none of that is actually staying there or causing any sort of response in the process. And thus, that is a lesson that all of us have. Are we just merely having noises bouncing on our ears? Or, yeah, are we actually taking this stuff in? Because basically you're saying these blessings and curses are putting forward, the one who created heaven and earth is wanting to create this place to be a place of blessing for all nations. But if you don't really see this as being something important to preserve, and something important to be a center for all of the world to be drawn in, then you're going to need a timeout. You're going to need a timeout, and that's called the exiles that are recorded there in the Word of God, to get a reset. And you see, yeah, okay, only a remnant of people returned from these exiles, but they got the lesson in the process. They got the lesson. Sadly, you could say that they overcorrected on some of those lessons about idolatry and say, okay, we don't want to bring in and mix with the people of the nations, because then what? It's just then going to be a mix of everything in with what we're doing. But then we see in the first century, it overcorrected to saying, oh, we stay away from everybody who's not us. And then we create high walls for them to be anywhere near us. And, you know, we've got our creator of heaven and earth here, and we don't want to corrupt him. So stay away, all you people out there. Even if you have all the instructions from the prophets, and even from what we see here in the Torah, that no, this is going to be a blessing for all nations. So yeah, if we see the parallel to this, parallel to these blessings and curses over in the end of Deuteronomy, and 29 talks about this, and you see some of it in Deuteronomy 30 as well. But you see that parallel is the same. You hear the message, you keep or you guard the message, you guard the instructions, you do the instructions, and then the prospering comes along as a result of that. So this is not some sort of prosperity gospel where it's like, okay, you know, if you do this, then you're going to get all of the blessings. One of the things that we often remind ourselves is that the saving or the redemption of the people proceeded before the blessings and the prospering. So you are saved, you are delivered, and then the prospering comes in. So it's not like you have one starting to drag along the other. And switching back over to Leviticus 27, one of the things that we remember, and we saw this as we were going over last week with the with Leviticus 25, to remember whose property this all is. And to remember what it is that we are actually entering into. And these people are the people of God going to be entering into this promised place where it was going to be a center point for the whole world. Whole world brought out of this. But in the process, you see that there would be, and we saw with the Jubilee, the Yovel, and with the Shemitah or the sabbatical year, that this was a cyclical reminder. Every 7 years and then every 50 years, you would get this reminder who it actually all belongs to. And to not try to grip onto everything so hard, to realize where it all comes down to. And we see that in Leviticus 27 again, where it's saying, hey, these valuations that you have when you're doing a vow or a dedication of something, it's all valued based on what? Leading up to the time of the Yovel or the Jubilee, or after the Yovel or is to the next one. So all of it is related to this time of release. So thus, if everything is related to that time period, what should we as people then think is important, right? The time of release, the one it all belongs to. That's why long ago, we had this orientation of our yearly calendars to Anno Domini, or the year of the Lord, was because we wanted to say, hey, all history revolves around this point in time. And you can quibble about, okay, yeah, they got the starting year wrong as to when that all began, off by a few years. But the point was, is that, hey, all of history is really revolving around this singular point in time when the Messiah came in here. So, in a very similar way in Israel's history, your whole civilization is round about this point in time of the Yovel. And that was the time when you were to release, let things go. Don't hold on to people's commitments to you. You have to let things go. And that we have a difficult time, whether we're talking about loans or property or issues that we have between people. We have a hard time letting things go. And this is one of the things that is a reminder in God's word, is like, hey, you have to let things go to not hold on to it so long. And to also keep in mind who it actually belongs to. And in Leviticus 27, you get this reminder again with these vows and with the tithes, is that if you want to redeem it, use it for something else. With the vows, you have to add a... I don't know if you call it a penalty payment, you might call it that, but basically saying, you know, if you want to get it back, you have to add 20% or add a fifth to the top of the valuation of that to get that back. And then with the tithe, it's saying, especially with animals, every tenth one, whether you think it's good or whether it's bad, that one is committed. If you want to replace it, meaning best case scenario, if it is one that is bad, like you would say not normally acceptable, it's got some sort of blemish, this or that or the other, you would think, oh, that's not a great gift for the King of heaven and earth. So what do? You give one that is a good gift to the King of heaven and earth. But the point is you're not swapping it out. You're saying, no, that one is committed. And if you commit another one, then that one also is committed. And you notice in there where it talks about, in a similar way, that one who is harem or devoted to destruction, it's what we call like the death penalty, you're not going to then say you're going to take that person out of that situation. Now, one of the things then you should then start thinking is, number one, okay, is the idea of a death penalty a place we ever want to go? But then the question that goes beyond that, if you do go there, be reminded of the process that it is not something you can walk back from if you do this. So thus, be extremely careful when you do this, which is why there is the long-standing tradition. There's not a terrible lot of support for it, but it's a long-standing tradition that the Sanhedrin or the council that has executed someone once in every, I forget how long period of time, is considered to have bloody hands. And that's the punchline of that is the Sanhedrin hardly ever sent anyone to death, which then should start making you start think of things that are talked about in the Gospels as being significant. Because the idea that you would try to argue yourself out of making such a sentence upon anyone and come up with all kinds of reasons why you should not do that, which is why you have the levels of evidence get up high in the Bible about the two witnesses. And then that gets taken on with tradition into what we have in the modern line of lines of evidence in cases that are even held up into the modern era. With that idea that, hey, you don't have any sort of kangaroo courts. And when we get into the time of Deuteronomy, you'll see that then start explaining for the judges, you know, you don't take bribes. You don't look with favor upon one person over another when they're at trial. You know, you have levels of your separation, so you don't have conflicts of interest, etc., where it's going on and saying, hey, this is something that you must keep pure. You must keep the mishpat or the judgment pure, because if you don't, then all of your society is going to start coming down around you if you can't make wise and clean decisions in the process, which is where you have that came down into modern law, where the presumption of innocence is a hallmark, especially in criminal trials, where, you know, as one of the founders of our country said, hey, it's better if you have a number of guilty people will go free than rather what? Than have one innocent person is executed. So yeah, it ends up being a very tough pill to swallow. But then those people who are in the role of judges, which is why we pray for them on a regular basis, pray for judges that they judge justly. They're not looking at faces or not biasing their rulings based on who's in front of them or their life situations or this or that, but rather you try to hold up justice as being the ultimate standard for where you're moving forward. So I talked about tithe there, that the fact that it already belongs to the Lord, so thus you're not going to be swapping it out. But one of the key things, and this comes down into something that's probably you're thinking about already, that you've heard Yeshua talk about a lot, that the fundamental aspects of a vow, or neder, which is where it is in Hebrew, is that it's a promise, but it is a voluntary promise. And like you see there in Numbers 30, verse 2, he shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. Okay, so what proceeds out of your mouth, thus you have to bring it forward and to make it actually happen if you're going to say it. But then you see earlier in Deuteronomy 23, 22, where it's also talking about vowing. It's like, if you refrain from vowing, it would not be sin to you. So one of the Bible's big points is you don't have to make a vow or a promise. A promise, and one of the things that you see without this is you're free to not make the promise, but you are not free to make a solemn commitment and then treat your own words as meaningless. So that's where I was talking about in the beginning. That's a challenge that I have myself, is if you overpromise and then underdeliver, that then what? Starts making your word like what? Yeah, garbage. Starts making your word like garbage. And if you are associated with the kingdom of heaven and people associate with you with that, what then do people start thinking about the kingdom of heaven if your word is garbage? Everything you've been telling me about the kingdom of heaven is what? Could be garbage. Doesn't live up to it, all the promises. Because you don't live up to your promises. So thus, when you start seeing there's the Ecclesiastes 5:5 talks about this. Also, it's better that you should not vow than you should vow and not pay. And you see similar things that are talked about there in the Gospels about let your yes be yes and your no be no. And the Apostle Yaakov or James says so also in his letter when he talks about that. You let your yes be yes and your no be no. The point is that if you are making a promise, and these vows came to be more standardized down into like in the first century, the Second Temple period, there is like a whole section, tractates of the Mishnah and the Talmud that's called the Nederot. Nederot meaning vows. And they talk about what a vow is. Can you enter into one unsuspectedly? You know, what happens if you get in over your head with a vow? And those sorts of things related to that. So thus, the terminology for that, and it should be familiar when it talks about where a vow is that if you're making a vow is a neder, but the thing that is the vow, what do you call it? The not collateral, but the sealing of the vow is the korban or the offering, the thing that reproaches. And as we've been going through Leviticus, that should start ringing bells for you, because that's what the offerings are called right at the beginning of the book. It is a korban, or the thing that approaches. So one of the things that you see throughout these the first century writings, and even writings in the centuries after that, was the idea that yes, you have to be extremely careful in what you say. But you say basically that this item is carbon to me, and I can no longer use it. I will no longer use this, which should make you start thinking about Mark chapter 7, where you know you see it recorded like, hey, yeah, that this gift I would give to you, it is karban. It is a gift to God. So basically, you are taking a vow that what your parents should be getting, because you are a dutiful child of your parents and you are honoring your parents, You've now just committed that to the service of heaven. You didn't have to do that, but you did have to honor your father and your mother. That is a commandment. That's one of the big 10, the 10 commandments. Honor your father and your mother. You must do that. But you decided to bypass that, decided to bypass that commandment with a voluntary thing of, I'm just going to give it away. I'm just going to give it away, not take care of my father and my mother in the process. And you can think of all the various reasons why one would do that. Maybe they think in themselves, hey, that has a higher task or a higher role that I should be playing, or maybe on a more baser level that I can get more recognition in the community if I give it away and make this gift, etc., rather than take care of my parents. So yes, we see quite a lot of this. So as we are kind of closing things out here today, one of the things we should take away from all of this is that the instruction, the call that comes out from the Messiah, hey, follow me. And really, that's what the kingdom of God is calling out to the whole world. Follow me. It's not just a invitation to join some sort of debate club or information society, or get on to follow something for notifications. And every so often you get bing, bing, popping up out of nowhere to tell you about something. And then you could just go, oh, swipe it off, because you're busy doing something else. No, rather, this is to, like what we were talking about before, if you are following after somebody to see where they're going and to go where they're going, and you're like in a mentorship or almost like an apprenticeship, you're watching what the person is doing, you're saying, I want to learn exactly what this person is doing, because why? Not because, hey, it's kind of useful knowledge I can drop in some sort of a cocktail party or with I'm talking with friends. No, it's because you are going to be actually doing it. An apprentice is going to be doing the job, and along the way, actually doing the job in the process and learning and doing and doing and learning. So that part is certainly along the lines of Shema. You are hearing, you are seeing, and you are doing in the process. And so these sorts of vows, that these are vows or promises we're making to heaven. And then also when you see the instructions in the word about, hey, let your yes be yes and your no, no, don't try to accentuate your language by saying, I swear to, or, so-and-so in heaven is behind me on this. No, don't have the creator of heaven and earth co-signing on whatever it is that you're trying to sell to somebody. Because, if you've ever been involved with co-signing on anything, that can be quite a disaster. It can be quite a disaster in the process, because you are yoking up with somebody, and Paul's instructions and the Torah's instructions about being unequally yoked can apply there with co-signing on this. So in the same way, you see these instructions in the Torah and the Gospels and in the apostolic writings in general, just saying, hey, don't try to have the creator of heaven and earth co-signing on whatever it is you're saying to try to sell it to somebody else. Just simply say it and mean it, and say it and do it. And when heaven is saying, hey, listen, do this, the point is not, that's an interesting concept. I'll have to kind of add that to my repertoire of various philosophies of the world. No, rather, this is the way of life. So we see that amongst the blessings and the curses at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, it says, what's set before you now is what? Life and death. Choose life. That's what heaven is saying. And that's what the mission of the people of God is, to really show the world there is life and death. Life and death. Ways that lead to life, ways that lead to death. Heaven wants you to choose life. Choose the way that leads to life. All right. So any last thoughts as we close out here? Yes, John, go ahead, please.
Yeshua is the life. Ergo, Yeshua is the Torah. Oh, and just a reminder.
Yeah. So thus, you can see why you see that the Apostle Yohanan or John starts out his gospel, you know, with the Word. Yeah, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Yes. And it was light, and the true light that came into the world. Yes. And then you see there in verse 14 where it says, and the Word became flesh, and then skinud or tabernacled, pitched his tent along with us. And really showing us, hey, that is what that whole tent going around with Israel in the midst of the people was all about. Because when we get to the end of Leviticus, thus what we see what the whole point of the tabernacle was all about. And with the korban. The korban, again in Hebrew, means the thing that approaches. Karav, the verb form of that is to approach. So thus, we're seeing that the korban or the offerings are a part of approaching the presence of God. They're not really about removing sin. You have various things that will be, you know, put upon the blood of the various offerings put upon. And then you also see with that altar there at the opening part where you have a conversion process of the person at the front of the gate and being symbolically, you know, converted over to the karvan, which is then going to approach the presence of God. But as we see in the middle of the book of Leviticus, and as you can see with a chiasm of the book, or an atbash, which is the Hebrew form of the same concept of where you have a parallel structure throughout the book of Leviticus, smack dab right in the middle is Leviticus 16 and 17, which is all about where the high priest is bearing Israel before the presence. Because that, indeed, on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, is where you have the picture of what actually is removing the sin, removing the transgressions, removing the iniquity, which is the big one. The big one is the iniquity, the willful rebellion, the treachery against the creator of heaven and earth. But that indeed is the picture of what Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, is all about in removing that. So thus, when you see the structure of the whole book, it's smack dab right in the middle of it is the picture of that removal. So, yes, Lindsay, go ahead, please.
Also, going back to your drawing of the tabernacle, it said it allows us to approach God.
Yes.
But also, just wanted to remind people that God can't look upon sin. And so when you accept Christ and you're covered by the blood of Christ,
which is why
you can look upon
the karvan. You can't just waltz in yourself. You have to then, the karvan goes in ahead of you. You are bringing your offering, the thing that will actually approach, but that is the thing that actually approaches. And that's pointing forward to the one who actually takes us into the presence. And something you see in the book of, and the letter of Hebrews, which talks about the one who takes us into the presence through the veil, into the presence of God, the Messiah being the one who does that.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. hallel.info